Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you happen to be listening to this. We are right on the verge at noon here at Concordia Seminary for another installment of Hebrew Club. Dr. Seleska is on the road, traveling to exciting, exotic places. Actually, I'm not exactly sure where he is, but I am filling in for him today, so we will have some fun going through 1 Samuel, picking up the narrative in chapter 28 at verse 16. Now, the story here in chapter 28 is King Saul's visit to the Witch of Endor, as the story is traditionally called. She is a medium who can consult the spirits of the dead, and the great irony through this whole chapter is that Saul, in obedience to Yahweh, has exiled or banished all spiritists and mediums from the land. But when he gets nervous about the conflict that he's in with the Philistines and it's coming to a head, and he desires to have a word from beyond, so to speak, to guide his actions, and the prophets of Yahweh are silent, instead of continuing to plead with Yahweh for guidance, he decides to consult one of the forbidden mediums. So he sets out to do so, and he encounters her, and he asks her to bring up the spirit, the dead spirit of Samuel, or I guess it doesn't say the dead spirit of Samuel, it just says to bring up Samuel, and she does so. And so in verse 15, we get Samuel's response to being disturbed. In verse 15, it says, "And Samuel said to Saul," find my place here, "And Samuel said to Saul, 'Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?' And Saul said, 'I have distressed greatly. I'm greatly distressed. And the Philistines are making war against me," an adversative bait there, "and God has turned aside from me, and he does not answer me ode any longer.'" And then you have a couple of gom phrases, which function as a neither nor here. "Neither by the hand of the prophets, but Yad HaNevi'im." There, Yad is functioning not literally by the hand of the prophets, but just as an idiom for agency, by means of the prophets. So neither by means of the prophets, nor by means of dreams. And so, I have called out to you, speaking to Samuel, so I have summoned you, in order to, a purpose clause there with a hithil infinitive construct with a lamed of purpose on the front. "So I have summoned you to make known to me." See the yada there in the hithil? "To make known," and then the ani ending, "to me, ma esa," what I should do. And that brings us then to verse 16, where we pick up today. Again, the irony is thick here. We have to see the irony all through the narrative of Saul's demise, going clear back into chapter 13, 15. We've seen that Saul has a problem listening to the voice of Yahweh. That's a continual theme. He does not shema the kol Yahweh. Instead, he shemas the kol of everybody else. He's always listening to the voice of the people, but he doesn't listen to the voice of Yahweh. Now, here he is, and he is desperately trying to get a word from Yahweh, and he's disobeying the explicit commands of Yahweh in order to get a word from Yahweh. So, on the one hand, he's desperately trying to shema the kol Yahweh, but on the other, he's not shemaing the kol Yahweh in the way he's going about it, speaking to the deceased Samuel through this medium. Verse 16, "Vayomer Shemuel v'lama tishaleni v'yahweh sar me'aleka v'hi areka." And Samuel said, "And why," the interrogative, "lama, and why tishaleni," another first person object suffix on the end, "why do you sha'al me," why do you inquire of me, or maybe, "why would you inquire of me?" If you give it kind of a modal sense there, that imperfect. "Why would you inquire of me, Yahweh sar," when literally, "and Yahweh has turned aside," or "and Yahweh has departed." Now, what's the relationship between these two clauses here? First, the question, why would you inquire of me? And then, and Yahweh has turned aside from you. It's not just an and, obviously, because that doesn't really fit together. Why would you inquire of me, and Yahweh has turned aside from you? Sometimes the simple vav...
since.
Okay, the sense is since. And what would we call that? What kind of a word is since? It's really a variant of a causal clause, or it's one possible translation of a causal clause. You could also translate it as a circumstantial clause, which also could read since or when. Why would you inquire of me when Yahweh has turned aside from you? Notice he's just echoing Saul's own words. Saul has just said in the previous verse, Yahweh has turned aside from me. That hollow root there, sar, loses its mater letter in the perfect. And take a look at this form, me'aleka. Notice that that's min plus all plus the second person singular suffix. Min likes to form together with other prepositions. It likes to form compound prepositions. And very often, with personal objects, when it's from a person, you'll get me'et or me'im. It always likes to form me'et or me'im. Here, interestingly, speaking of Yahweh departing from you, from Saul, it uses all, from upon you, or from above you, or something like that. I'm not sure why it chooses, why the narrator uses all here. Perhaps because of the image of the Spirit of Yahweh coming upon Saul, resting on Saul. That may be why he chooses to use me'aleka here. It really doesn't matter, because in English we usually translate those compound prepositions with just a single English preposition. So you see something like me'et, from with, or may all, from upon. In English we usually just say from. Since Yahweh has departed from you, vahi areka, and he is, from hayah, and then your are, whatever an are is. The problem with this word here, the last word of verse 16, is that the lexicons say this is a textual corruption, and they don't exactly know what the word means, or what it was supposed to be. So there, this same word in the plural is used in the Psalms. It's used in Psalm 139, verse 20, and it means enemies in that context. And here it seems to mean enemy, perhaps. It could be that it's a misreading or a miswriting of an initial tsade. The little word tsar means oppressor or enemy. So it could be that this is a textual corruption of tsar. Another interesting possibility is that the Septuagint translates this as saying, and is with your neighbor, or and is with your fellow man. And that, in Hebrew, would be re'ah, with the initial two letters just exchanged. So you would just switch the ayin and the resh, and you could get re'aka. And that is how the next verse concludes, with that idea that God has given the kingdom to your re'aka, to your fellow man, to David. So that's another possibility here. But as the text stands, if you just read the word as enemy, the sense is Yahweh has turned aside from you and he is your enemy. Pretty strong language. Yahweh is your enemy. Hayah, in addition to meaning is, oftentimes means is or... can mean to happen. It can also mean to become. So Yahweh has become your enemy. Any other questions on 16?
For Yahweh, how come there's not a swat underneath the yes? Is it because of the...
That's a great question. Yeah. Yeah, this is a kind of a fun deal. You normally take this for granted when you see Yahweh mispointed in Hebrew, because you're used to seeing it. But what is the pointing on Yahweh? It's not pointed as Yahweh. The vowels are for Adonai. So you get a schwa under the yod, and then a comments under the vav, and they leave off the O vowel, which would go above. it's pointed for Adonai, which begins with a compound schwa, a katef patak, a compound schwa with a patak. And so when you add a simple schwa under the conjunction, under the vav, before a compound schwa, rule of schwa kicks in. You guys remember learning these rule of schwas? If you learn from the Bartel textbook, he calls them rule of schwa A and rule of schwa B. And rule of schwa A, if you have two simple schwas, the second one should disappear and the first one should become a, or the second one can stay actually, except for under a yod, and the first one becomes a hirik. Okay, under a yod, that second schwa disappears and you would just get viva or something like that here. It would look like anyway in the text. But it's not pointed as Yahweh, it's pointed as Adonai. So when you put the simple schwa in front of the compound schwa, you have to employ rule of schwa B, which makes the schwa under the conjunction into a patak. It takes the same vowel as the compound schwa. So it does look a little strange there, but it's just a simple schwa in front of, or simple vav, I should say, simple conjunction in front of Yahweh. All right, let's go on. Other questions on 16. Okay, verse 17. Vayas Yahweh lo asher deber b'yadi. Vayikra Yahweh et hamam laka meyadeka. Vayitana l'reyaka l'david. And Yahweh has done to you ka'asher, just as he spoke by my hand. Same idiom as above, by the hand of the prophets, in other words, through me. Just as he spoke through me. Remember, this is Samuel speaking to Saul here. Samuel had warned Saul that the kingdom would be taken from him, and now it's happening. In fact, it's happening right now, here in these days. Saul is experiencing the silence of Yahweh, the forsaking of Yahweh. He knows that. That's why he's so desperate. He's going to the witch of Endor, and Samuel is confirming his worst fears here with this oracle. Yahweh has done to you just as he spoke through me, and Yahweh has karad, he has torn. I always think the way that I remember kara, to tear, in this form is that it's kind of like kara, to proclaim or to read. And there's this great narrative in Jeremiah where King Jehoiakim gets the scroll of the prophet Jeremiah. Baruch has written it down and it's been read in the public square and people are all upset because it contains the judgments of God that are coming against the city of Jerusalem and the Davidic kingship. And the scroll is brought to King Jehoiakim, and his attendants are all upset and nervous, and they're worried. And it's read out loud in his presence, kara, with an aleph on the end, to read aloud, which is the same verb as to proclaim. It's read in his presence, and as it's read, he takes a penknife, and as the scribe is reading it, he starts cutting off all the stuff that's already been read, a few lines at a time, and tossing it into the fire that's burning beside him. And the prophet, in commenting on this narrative, says that when the scroll was read, the king did not tear his clothes, nor did any of those with him. In other words, the proper response to the karaing of God's judgment, the reading of it aloud, is to kara your garments, to repent. And so that's an interesting and easy way to remember those two verbs. Kara with an ayin is to rent or tear something. Kara with an aleph is to proclaim or to read aloud. So Yahweh is the one karaing here, and Yahweh has torn, direct object, the kingdom from your hand, and he has given her. Notice when you have a hey on the end of the verb here with the dot in it, that's called a matik. And it signals usually that it's a pronominal suffix on the end rather than some kind of a vowel ending or something. So, and he has given her, referring to the kingdom, to your reah, to your comrade, to David. Notice the way that Hebrew, when it puts two nouns in apposition in a prepositional phrase, usually repeats the preposition. In English, we would say, to your fellow man, comma, David. But Hebrews says, to your fellow man, to David, repeats the Lamed. Notice also here that Reah, while sometimes it's glossed in Hebrew texts as friend, doesn't always have that intimate of a sense. In this context, David is not Saul's friend. He's his fellow man, his neighbor, you might say. Any questions on 17? Okay, verse 18. Ka'asher lo shemata b'kol Yahweh v'lo asita karon apo ba'amalek. All kain hadavar hazeh asalaka Yahweh hayom hazeh. We've just had ka'asher as just as, but it can also function as a conjunction meaning because. So here it's introducing a reason, and you might think now that this is the reason why Yahweh has taken away the kingdom and given it to David, but in fact it's going to be followed in the middle of the verse by all Cain, therefore. And those two are paired within this verse. So you have because this, therefore this. So we're getting actually the reason ahead of time of something that's going to follow. What's the because? Because you didn't Shema b'kol Yahweh. Shema, when its object is prefaced by the preposition be, has a particular nuance. Shema means to listen to, but to Shema be something means more than just to listen to. It means to hearken to actually listen and act on, or in English we would say obey. So oftentimes Shema plus be is translated obey, because you did not obey the voice of Yahweh, and you did not do karon apo. What's karon apo? Anybody know? Apo is his off, his nose or anger. And karon means burning or glowing. So literally it's because you did not do the glowing of his nose. And this is a Hebrew idiom for his burning anger. Because you did not do his burning anger, Ba'amalek. Amalek is a proper noun, Amalek, the Amalekites, or Amalek, the nation. And the preposition bait here is adversative, against. So because you did not do the burning anger of Yahweh against Amalek, therefore, all Cain, Hadavar Hazeh, this, not word, but this thing, Dabar can mean thing or matter. This thing he has done to you, who has Yahweh, Hayom Hazeh, this day. So this day is not, in this particular context, necessarily this very day. In fact, it has already begun in the forsaking of Saul's experience of God's forsaking him, and in a little bit we're going to find out tomorrow is the real day in terms of Saul's fate. Any questions on 18?
You said that Shema with bait is when it takes the nuance of obey. Is it properly interpreted as obey apart from the bait?
There is that nuance in places, but there may be places where the context seems to suggest that. But the bait makes it pretty clear that that's what's going on. When the psalmists cry out to Yahweh, they sometimes will call out to Yahweh in the imperative and ask him to Shema b'koli, listen to my voice. And they use the bait on the front there. Then it's usually translated not obey my voice, but it's translated hearken to my voice. In other words, do more than just hear, but do something. Right? They want Yahweh to respond, to help, to save, to deliver. So, even when it's addressed to God, it has, with the bait on its object, more of a nuance than just to merely hear.
Would the Lamed, would it do the same thing? Like the Shema plus the Lamed?
It's less strong with the Lamed, and the Lamed is probably the more usual Lamed, or the preposition El, to listen to. Alright, other questions? Verse 19. Vayetain Yahweh gam et Yisrael imakah b'yad pelishtim. makar ata ubaneka imi. Gam et makane Yisrael yatain Yahweh b'yad Pelishtim. And Yahweh has given also Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. Now the has given here has not actually, they haven't actually lost the battle yet, but this is a prophetic declaration, right? The decision has been made. Yahweh has given Israel with you into the hand of the Philistines. And makar, tomorrow, the adverb tomorrow, ata ubaneka imi. And then you have the atnak, the pause. What a short but powerful little clause here, right in the midst of this oracle. Literally, tomorrow, you and your sons, imi, with me. Tomorrow, you and your sons with me. Who's talking? A dead man. Okay? Samuel is saying to Saul, tomorrow you and your sons, we would say in English, making it a verbless clause, and since it's modified by makar, tomorrow we would say will be. Tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. And then he repeats this idea that Israel also is included. Find my place here. Gam et makane Yisrael yatain Yahweh b'yad Pelishtim. And also the makane, the camp of Israel, Yahweh has given into the hand of the Philistines. So here's the order of the judgment of God falling on the people. It's Saul, the house of Saul, all Israel is going to be included in the downfall of this man. Any questions there? You might notice the similarity between the two words, makar, tomorrow, and then the first verb of the next verse, mahar, which means to hurry. And as an adverb, sometimes has the sense of to do something quickly. So verse 20 begins, Vaymaher Sha'ul, Vayipol Melo Komato Artha. Vayirah Ma'od Midivrei Shemuel. We'll stop at the Atnak there. And Saul hurried, and he fell. And Saul hurried, and he fell. This is an example of what Bartelt, in his textbook, calls verbal hendiadys. It's two verbs actually contributing to one verbal action, one sense. And the first verb acts in an adverbial sense. So we wouldn't say in English, he hurried and he fell, but we would say probably, and immediately Saul fell. And immediately Saul fell. Notice the disappearance of the nun there on that first nun root, nafal, goes into the dagesh there in the pay. And Saul immediately fell, molo komato artsa. Molo is a noun meaning fullness, and koma means height or stature. So he fell, fullness of his stature, artsa. What's artsa?
Toward the earth.
Good, it's eretz with the directive hey on the end. Now what do you do in a clause like this when you have a verb with an implied subject, and then this noun just sitting there, fullness of his height, and then what actually acts as a prepositional phrase, towards the earth. What do you do with that fullness of his height? And he fell, fullness of his height, towards the earth. In English, we would render it, he fell stretched out, or prostrate, or lengthwise, or something like that. To the earth. But grammatically what's going on here is you have a noun that's not the subject. This is a really important thing, a really helpful thing to remember in Hebrew, because this is not something you typically learn very clearly in elementary Hebrew. When you're reading in Hebrew syntax and you come to a noun and it's not the subject, and it's not the direct object, and it's not the object of a preposition. Those are the three things you're used to nouns being: subject, object, or object of the preposition. When it doesn't fall into any of those categories, it's very often an adverb, acting in an adverbial way. We call that an adverbial accusative in some other languages, and so in Hebrew sometimes we use that label as well. And this would be an adverbial accusative of manner. It's describing how he fell. How did he fall? Fullness of his stature wise, you might say. Why is this ironic in the narrator's depiction here of this account of Saul's downfall?
Because his height was struck Samuel when he was, went forward to anoint.
Yeah, this is part of Saul's identity as king, right? And it's also one thing that sets Saul apart from David, who's been chosen not because of outward appearance, but because of God who sees the heart, not as man sees, but as God sees the heart. And so now here's this Superman, in a sense, Saul, this tall Saul, and he's falling down. And the narrator actually describes that very explicitly here. So he falls down lengthwise to the earth, Vayir'ah, and he feared greatly. This form, Yir'ah, here is an example, at least from my teaching of elementary Hebrew, of the dictum, all grammar teachers lie. Because I always tell my students that when you see the form Yare in the imperfect, in the third person forms, it will always have two yods. You can always tell the difference between Yare, to fear, and Ra'ah, which oftentimes loses its hey and it's just Reishayim, by the fact that when there's a yod performative, there will be two yods on Yare. Well, not always, and especially in the book of Samuel. If you've been following along for very long with Seleska in these sessions, you've seen a few examples of Yare forming like this. In Samuel, it tends to have only one yod. So, and he feared greatly, midivrei Shemuel, because of the words of Samuel. That's a causal min there. You see how that's functioning? And that's a standard idiom with the verb yare, to fear. Oftentimes you yare min something. You are afraid of, or afraid because of, blank. Gam ko lo haya bo. Also, or in addition to his great fear, koach, I read that as ko, but it's koach. What's koach mean? Strength. In addition, strength, lo haya bo, strength was not in him. We would probably say there was no strength in him. Ki, because, lo akal lechem, because he had not eaten bread, kol hayom v'kol halayla, all that day and all that night. Questions on verse 20.
Do you get the impression that the did he before he came or after?
Well, he's coming at night in the context. So must be the day before and during that particular night in which they've been journeying to Endor and consulting this woman. He hasn't eaten. Well, we should probably... We're going to get into food stuff, leads us into food stuff, which occupies most of the rest of this chapter, and we probably don't have time to get through all of it, so we'll stop there for the day. Are there any other questions on this text? We'll pick up there when we resume next Thursday.
Yeah, thanks. Is there a